live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City. And I welcome you to this program. I've been listening to some of the commentaries by radio and television hosts during the past few days on the 10th anniversary of our engagement in Iraq. Today I would like to honor those people who fought against the war in Iraq and continue to do so in Afghanistan, as well as those soldiers who have been victims of that conflict. After our health and nutrition and our environmental segments, we'll have a newsmaker guest, Dr. Sarah Gottfried, Harvard-trained medical doctor, talking about preventing and treating hormonal imbalances. Then I will do a series of commentaries from individuals, including reading a letter that I've posted from Thomas Young. It is addressed to George Bush and Dick Cheney, and it's about what a dying man has to say, his last letter. Also, we've been told that one of the rationales for our engagement in Iraq was to bring freedom and democracy and greater opportunity to the women of Iraq, as we did for Afghanistan. The trouble is, it didn't work in Afghanistan. And as you will see from a leading woman from Iraq, it has not worked in Iraq, but it's even worse. What the embedded American journalist refused to say, refused to cover. For Iraqi women, America's promise of democracy is anything but liberation. Also from Professor Paul Craig Roberts, Iraq After 10 Years, and new information, brand new today, from the BBC's award-winning program Panorama, they revealed that the CIA and M16, that's the British equivalent to the CIA, were told before the invasion that Iraq had no active weapons of mass destruction from top Iraqi officials. Hence, Tony Blair knew that. And then what's this war actually cost us? I'll get into that. I'm not sure how much of that I'll have time to explore, but we'll get a lot shared today. Let's begin with health and nutrition as we do every day. Another study on fish oil. Now, we've already seen that fish oil helps turn off inflammation in the brain and therefore can be very beneficial for men and women suffering from dementia and Alzheimer's. It also helps re-regulate an irregular heartbeat. That's good, along with hawthorn and magnesium and L-carnitine. We now find out that it's also important that if we have enough omega-3 fatty acid, it can help prevent blood clotting, hence help prevent stroke. There's one more that we can add to that. This is the latest study, and it says that the omega-3 fatty acids, according to researchers, can enhance a woman's libido. Well, that's good news. And he goes on to talk about why it does that, how it does it, the DHA, the different types of fatty acids in the woman's body, and how that impacts her hormone levels and how that impacts her libido. All good. So for women who are having a low libido, the omega-3 fatty acids, 2 to 3,000 milligrams a day, could help you. Cloves. We rarely eat cloves, but cloves are one of the best natural antioxidants. This is brand new research, and what they have found is that using the spices, which, by the way, the cloves are commonly used in Mediterranean dishes, and but they're great antioxidants. They protect your body. Hence, if you were to have food each day that had cinnamon and cloves, sage and mint and rosemary and dill and oregano, by the way, that's a very common group of herbs that are used almost every day in the Mediterranean diet, but not in the American diet. In the American diet, we use MSG, salt, and pepper. We use ketchup, mustard, and mayonnaise. And we do not have the background currently for using a wide variety of aromatic herbs. That's changing, but not to any great effect. The researchers at Miguel Hernandez University found that cloves were in first place as far as their natural protective antioxidants. And it's because they have very high phenolic compounds. Quote, out of the five antioxidant properties tested, cloves had the highest capacity to give off hydrogen, reduce lipid peroxidation well, and was the best iron reducer. And that was published in a peer-reviewed journal. So one more reason to use cloves. Now, how would I use cloves? How could you use them? It's simple. You could use some ground cloves or put whole cloves in a blender in the morning in your smoothie. That's one way. You could put it into rice and add in curry and or cumin, cardamom, anise, and pearl onions, and you get a very Mediterranean type of rice. You could even take some organic tomatoes, and you dump them in some boiling water for about 30 seconds. That's all. Take them out, peel off the skin, and then cut them into about a quarter inch slices, and then gently stir that. Now that makes a great sauce, and you pour that over your rice, and you can use cloves in that. It sweetens up the whole tomato dish. Anyhow, let's get our clove into our diet. Now, the Russians have herbal treatments to help thyroid conditions. We have an epidemic of thyroid, hypothyroid, and in diabetics, hyperthyroid conditions in the United States. Well, what they have found is in reviewing their traditional approaches, there's a plant, and the plant is called Potentilla alba. That's Potentilla alba. It's also called white cinquefoil, cinquefoil. And it's been used to treat people with goiter, hyperthyroidism, and hypothyroidism. And very successfully. And it was tested at the State Medicine Scientific Research Institute and the Federal Medical and Biological Agency in Russia. It was very successful. So something else for you to be able to use. Sleep loss alters the genes, and at the same time, it raises the risk of disease. This is from Bloomberg News, and here's what it just, I think this is important. Just 1 week of inadequate sleep can alter the activity of hundreds of genes, which may help scientists explain how wakeful nights can lead to ailments like diabetes, obesity, and heart disease. Now, why is that the case? Well, it's relatively straightforward. When you go to bed at night, try your best to relax before you go to bed. You never want to take your stressors to sleep with you because you'll be thinking. And if you're thinking a stressful thought, that creates a cortisol rush. And cortisol, when it increases, brings your blood sugar with it because it's your fight or flight hormone. Here's how it works. Let's say that you're asleep and suddenly you hear a noise, like you think it's a window breaking downstairs. Immediately, all of your body senses are on full alert. Your pulse rate increases. Your muscle strength increases. Your glucose is flooding your body because you may have to flee or you may have to fight. Hence the flight or fight response. Cortisol is the messenger that causes that to happen. So let's say that you go to bed and you're worried about things. Now your worrying triggers cortisol, just as if you were being invaded downstairs. As a result, your blood sugar rises, and now even if you want to sleep, even if you're tired, your blood sugar is not allowing you to sleep. That's one way. A separate way, you ache too close to going to bed. Now the body can't just let food sit there. Automatically, 24/7, when food goes in, it has to come out. It has to be broken down. The whole purpose for the body is to take nutrients out of the food that you've eaten and absorb it into the cells where it can be used to strengthen the cells and give life to the cells. However, let's say that you don't have food there because you want to strengthen or help the cells. You're watching a movie. Like a lot of people, you bought some stuff, and that was 2 hours ago or 3 hours ago. Well, that's still in your stomach. And if there's fat in it, it's not going to go anywhere for quite some time. Or you had a late dinner. Okay, you had a late dinner. Now it's 3 hours later. You're tired. That's still in your stomach. So that means that your body has to start an anabolic process, which is digestion. Even though you're in a catabolic process, recovery and sleep and detoxification. There's another reason. You're watching your computer, and you weren't aware that within 5 feet of your computer, electromagnetic pulses hitting your body, including your brain. And those electromagnetic pulses can adversely affect the chromosomes and overheat the cells. And that causes a whole series of biochemical reactions which necessitate glucose. Hence, your body biochemistry is up. Or you're on a cell phone, same phenomena. Or you're sleeping beside a digital clock, same thing. Or you didn't realize when you flip off the television, you didn't disconnect the power, same thing. Or it's a really cold night, so you're sleeping with electric blanket, really bad, same thing. Or you went to sleep, but you're used to having some kind of light on. The eyelid notices differences in light and tells the brain, it's time to wake up. But the brain is saying, I haven't been to sleep. And the light is saying, it doesn't matter, get up. So the brain doesn't know what to do, and hence you don't get the release of melatonin from the pineal gland necessary to give you that protective power that the melatonin hormone gives you. It's one of the most powerful natural substances released by the body. So you wake up tired. Your body hasn't been fully detoxed and cleansed. All that happens. That's how we get sick. And unfortunately, most people, it's chronic because our habits are chronic, like eating when we watch television at night. Next, we've used a lot of echinacea, I'm sure, in this audience because it helps prevent colds, it builds the immune system. This is the latest study. This is from Tulsa World, and I thought it was interesting. It's from Cardiff University in the United Kingdom. It was a big study. Quote, it's the season for the common cold with over 1 billion cases, that's with a B, billion, in the United States each year. What that means is the average person could be getting 4 or 5 colds a year. Sneezing is perhaps the most annoying symptom of all. Most people don't realize sneezing is actually your neurological response. Dust, change in temperature, or even a bright light can cause impulses to build up in the sneezing center of the brain. Signals are then transmitted to nerve endings, and then you sneeze. It's actually a protective mechanism of your body. Tell that to the person who gets wet from your spewing mucus. Now, medicine helps, it says, if you have a stuffy nose, and or nasal spray. But here's what it says about echinacea. Echinacea is a perennial flower native to the eastern North America that wakes up the immune system to help you fight infections. We just learned that daily consumption of echinacea may help stave off the common cold. A large study done at Cardiff University in the United Kingdom demonstrated that taking echinacea for 4 months significantly decreases your likelihood of catching a cold. It may also shave time off your illness by 26%. The study also showed that these preventative effects continued to increase with regular echinacea consumption, something that is crucial. So, that's good news. So, to prevent a cold, we've been saying this for decades. Vitamin C, astragalus, echinacea, garlic, and onion. Those are your really good cold preventatives. And finally, for those of you who have coughing from reasons other than a cold or a cold, I'm going to share some remedies. So please write them down. They can help control the flu and bronchitis and asthma and pneumonia, which should be medically treated, of course, and post-nasal drip and congestion and sinusitis. Here they are. And there's good literature on all of them, and you can Google each one. Let's start with white hoarhound. It's been used by Native Americans as well as an Ayurvedic practice for a long time. It's an expectorant. What that does, it allows you to get the mucus out of your chest and out of your throat and out of your head. It can also help relieve dry coughs. It's very strongly anti-inflammatory and relieves spasmodic coughing-related bronchitis and asthma. I would use this with raw honey, and I would also put in to that some bee propolis. Not the best tasting stuff, and a little, almost like a thick oil. Kind of smell and taste like it too. But it really works. It's a natural antibiotic. And then fenugreek. Fenugreek loosens the tightness in the airwaves. It also has astringent qualities that relieves sinus congestion and helps speed up postnasal drip healing. It's especially good for people who are suffering from pneumonia or the flu. And again, I'm suggesting if you have something as serious as pneumonia, you shouldn't be trying to treat it yourself. It should be medically treated because you could die from that. But I'm suggesting this as a preventative, and I'm also suggesting this as a complementary way of approaching the condition. An old favorite in the United States, going back a long time, is slippery elm. Slippery elm causes the body to create a mucus film in the throat and airways and clear down. And that protects it, and that soothes your throat, especially if you've got that dry cough. And you can get slippery elm lozenges, probably the best way of using it. An old-fashioned remedy that's so simple, you simply take the juice of 3 lemons, squeeze them, roll the lemon with the palm of your hand, putting some pressure so you open up the cells, cut it, squeeze the juice of 3 lemons, and put 1 teaspoon of organic wild manuka honey in it. And that is good too. That, or you could use it cold. I use that. I do exactly that, except I use a lot more lemons because I have a lemon orchard on my farm. I have about, 40 lemon trees. Some give off 1,000 fruits. Huge. You can see photographs of these trees and the fruit they bear. All the fruit that you see, I grow. And when I'm in my home, I'm able to go out with a gigantic bowl. It's a stainless steel bowl. It's big, about 2 gallons. And I'll pick grapefruit, lemons, limes, oranges, cherries, figs, grapefruit, tangerines, grapes, star fruit, persimmons. I have over 100 different types of fruit, and I'll just go in and I make myself fruit bowl, and then I go around, and that's one of the ways I bond with my wonderful and loving little creatures that live there also. The capuchins and even the peacocks come up and eat right out of your hand. Fresh fruit. Now, lemon is one of the most healing of all fruits. It's one of the best. It's a superstar. Now, if you can get raw organic honey, that's good also. And the two together kill bacteria and viruses in your throat. And that's good for you. It also helps build your immune system, is rich in antioxidants, and can help a sore throat. In fact, if you have a sore throat, before you go to bed at night, just take a teaspoon of honey, put it in the back of your throat, and just let it dissolve there. It's going to do a lot of good overnight. Ginkgo biloba also has been used for thousands of years for respiratory conditions, including helping stopping wheezing and sneezing and expelling phlegm from the air passages. Mullein, M-U-L-L-E-I-N, that's really good also. And that's good for bronchitis and the flu. Fennel, which is an Ayurvedic herb, used in India an awful lot. I would use it also. And how do you use fennel? You can actually make a fennel tea. When you're putting that lemon in there, put about half a teaspoon of fennel in and stir it around. That's good, especially if you want to help bronchitis, influenza. So make sure that you at least have these things in your home. They can make a difference. I'm Gary Anall, back in a moment with our commentaries. Please stay with us. Sitting in the front row of a lecture I gave out in Los Angeles, the man who was just singing that. This is from Thomas Young, and if anyone can reach Thomas Young, let him know that there are some things that can be done, even at the end of life, even in hospice care. I don't know where he's at, but I'm willing to help him, and I'm willing to send a healthcare provider on my dime to him if he wants one last effort at trying. To George Bush and Dick Cheney, from Thomas Young. I write this letter on the 10th anniversary of the Iraq War on behalf of my fellow Iraq War veterans. I write this letter on behalf of 4,488 soldiers and Marines who died in Iraq. I write this letter on behalf of the hundreds of thousands of veterans who have been wounded and on behalf of those whose wounds, physical and psychological, have destroyed their lives. I'm one of those gravely wounded. I was paralyzed in an insurgent ambush in 2004 in Sadr City. My life is coming to an end. I'm living under hospice care. I write this letter on behalf of husbands and wives who've lost spouses. On behalf of children who've lost a parent. On behalf of the fathers and mothers who've lost sons and daughters. And on behalf of those who care. For the many thousands of my fellow veterans who have brain injuries. I write this letter on behalf of those veterans whose trauma and self-revulsion for what they have witnessed, endured, and done in Iraq have led to suicide. And on behalf of the active duty soldiers and Marines who commit, on average, a suicide a day. I write this letter on behalf of some 1 million Iraqi dead and on behalf of the countless war wounded. I write this letter on behalf of us all. Your war has left behind all of us who have suffered, those who will spend their lives in unending pain and grief. I write this letter, my last letter to you, Mr. Bush, Mr. Cheney. I write not because I think you grasp the terrible human and moral consequences of your lives and manipulation and thirst for wealth and power. I write this letter because, before my own death, I want to make it clear that I and hundreds of thousands of my fellow veterans along with millions of my fellow citizens, along with hundreds of millions more in Iraq and the Middle East, know fully who you are and what you have done. You may evade justice, but in our eyes, you're each guilty of egregious war crimes, of plunder, and of murder, including the murder of thousands of young Americans, my fellow veterans, whose future you stole. Your positions of authority, your millions of dollars of personal wealth, your public relations consultants, your privilege and your power cannot mask the hollowness of your character. You sent us to fight and die in Iraq after you, Mr. Cheney, dodged the draft in Vietnam and you, Mr. Bush, went AWOL from your National Guard unit. Your cowardice and selfishness were established decades ago. You were not willing to risk yourselves for our nation, but you sent hundreds of thousands of young men and women to be sacrificed in a senseless war with no more thought than it takes to put out the garbage. I joined the Army 2 days after 9/11 attacks. I joined the Army because our country had been attacked. I wanted to strike back at those who had killed some 3,000 of my fellow citizens. I did not join the Army to go to Iraq, a country that had no part in the September attacks and did not pose a threat to their neighbors, much less the United States. I did not join the Army to liberate Iraqis or to shut down mythical weapons of mass destruction facilities or to implant what you cynically called democracy in Baghdad in the Middle East. I did not join the Army to rebuild Iraq, which at the time you told us could be paid for by Iraq's oil revenues. Instead, this war has cost the United States over $3 trillion. I especially did not join the Army to carry out preemptive war. The preemptive war is illegal under international law, and as a soldier in Iraq I was, I now know, abetting your idiocy and your crimes. The Iraq War is the largest strategic blunder in U.S. history. It obliterated the balance of power in the Middle East. It installed a corrupt and brutal pro-Iranian government in Baghdad, one cemented in power through the use of torture, death squads, and terror, and has left Iran as the dominant force in the region. On every level, moral, strategic, military, and economic, Iraq was a failure, and it was you, Mr. Bush and Mr. Cheney, who started this war. It was you who should pay the consequences. I would not be writing this letter if I had been wounded fighting in Afghanistan against those forces that carried out the attacks of 9/11. Had I been wounded there, I would still be miserable because of my physical deterioration and imminent death. But I would at least have the comfort of knowing that my injuries were a consequence of my own decision to defend the country I love. I would not have to lie in my bed, my body filled with painkillers, my life ebbing away, and deal with the fact that hundreds of thousands of human beings, including children, including myself, were sacrificed by you for little more than the greed of oil companies, for your alliance with the oil sheikhs of Saudi Arabia, and your insane visions of empire. I have, like many other disabled veterans, suffered from the inadequate and often inept care provided by the Veterans Administration. I have, like many other disabled veterans, come to realize that our mental and physical wounds are of no interest to you, perhaps of no interest to any politician. We were used, we were betrayed, and we've been abandoned. You, Mr. Bush, make much pretense of being a Christian, but isn't lying a sin? Isn't murder a sin? Aren't theft and selfish ambitions sins? I'm not a Christian, but I believe in the Christian ideal. I believe that what you do to the least of your brothers, you finally do to yourself, to your own soul. My day of reckoning is upon me. Yours will come. I hope you would be put on trial, but mostly I hope for your sakes that you find the moral courage to face what you have done to me and to many others who deserved to live. I hope that before your time on earth ends, as mine is now ending, you will find the strength of character to stand before the American public and the world, and in particular the Iraqi people, and beg for forgiveness. Thomas Young. This is from Haifa Sangana from The Guardian. A decade on from the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq, The destruction caused by foreign occupation and the subsequent regime has had a massive impact on Iraqis' daily life, the most disturbing example of which is violence against women. At the same time, the sectarian regime's policy on religious garb is forcing women to retire their hard-earned rights across the spectrum: employment, freedom of movement, civil marriage, welfare benefits, and the right to education and health services. Instead, they are seeking survival and protection for themselves and their families. But for many, the violence they face comes from the very institution that should guarantee their safety, the government. Iraqi regime officials often echo the same denials of the U.S.-UK occupation and authorities, saying that there are very few or no women detainees. An increasing number of international and Iraqi human rights organizations report otherwise. The plight of women detainees was the starting point for the mass protests that have spread through many of Iraq provinces in the last 3 months. Their treatment by the security forces has been a bleeding wound, and one shrouded in secrecy, especially since 2003, when women have been routinely detained as hostages, a tactic to force their male loved ones to surrender to security forces or confess to crimes ascribed to them. Banners and placards carried by hundreds of thousands of protesters portray images of women behind bars pleading for justice. According to an Iraqi MMP, Muhammad al-Daini, there are 1,053 cases of documented rape by the occupying troops and Iraqi forces. Lawyers acting on behalf of former detainees say the UK detention practices included unlawful killings, beatings, hooding, sleep deprivation, forced nudity, and sexual humiliation, including women and children. The abuses were endemic, alleged the detainees' lawyers, arising from the, quote, systems, management, culture, and training of the military. These same occupation forces trained Iraqi forces. Abuses often occurred under the supervision of U.S. commanders who were unwilling to intervene. As the Washington Post reported, quote, of all the bloodshed in Iraq, none may be more disturbing than the campaign of torture and murder being conducted by U.S.-trained government police forces, end quote. In the aftermath of Abu Ghraib, detainees were handed over to Iraqi forces. This enabled them to be tortured while occupation troops could disclaim responsibility. Today, Iraq can boast one of the highest execution rates in the world. In a single day, 34 individuals, including two women, were executed. An act described by the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Navi Pillay, as shocking, quote, given the lack of transparency in court proceedings, major concerns about due process and fairness of trials, and the very wide range of offenses for which the death penalty can be imposed in Iraq, end quote. No wonder, 10 years after the invasion, the Iraqi authorities are accused by U.S. Human Rights Watch of, quote, violating with impunity the rights of Iraq's most vulnerable citizens, especially women and detainees. Human Rights Watch's account is echoed by a report by the Iraqi Parliament's own Human Rights and Women's and Family and Children's Committees, which found there were 1,030 women detainees suffering rape. Responding to these findings, Prime Minister Nouri Maliki threatened, quote, arrest those members of the Parliament who have discussed the violence against women detainees, end quote. Protesters and Iraqi human rights organizations estimate that there are 5,000 female detainees. The truth is leaking out drip by drip. A few weeks ago, 168 women detainees were released, and there were promises that another 32 would be released. But not a single person was released if they talked about torture, rape, or abuse. And it was all supposed to be so different. That was what Iraqi women were promised. A political quota system established in post-invasion Iraq was designed to ensure that at least 25% of members of parliament were women. That was applauded as a great achievement of the new Iraq, compared with 8% female representatives under the Ba'athist regime. But this token statistic has repeatedly been trotted out to cover up the regime's crimes against women. In reality, the al-Maliki government has since dispensed with the quota for government posts. There is only one woman minister among 44 ministers. But even this appointment contains a grim irony. The Minister for Women's Affairs is Al-Zaidi. And here's what she said, quote, "I am against the equality between men and women. If women are equal to men, they're going to lose a lot," end quote. And that is the only woman minister, and she is the head of women's affairs, and she's against equal rights. Perhaps unsurprisingly, many women's organizations have demanded the abolition of the Ministry of Women's Affairs after the minister adopted a position against rather than for women's rights. Human rights, including women's rights, are a litmus test for democracy. Statements by senior officials, including the prime minister himself, show that, contrary to what some Iraqis had hoped for, the liberators have actually set the conditions for the continuity of injustice, and that in turn has given rise to extremism. End quote. And one more before we go to our guest. A short one here that's important. This is from the BBC. Now, the BBC has an award-winning program on called Panorama. This is brand new information. I saw it nowhere in the American media this morning. Quote, "Fresh evidence has revealed how M16 and the CIA were told through secret channels by Saddam Hussein's foreign minister and his head of intelligence that Iraq had no active weapons of mass destruction. Tony Blair knew this, and he told Parliament before the war that intelligence showed Iraq's nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons program was active, growing, and up and running. A special BBC Panorama program, aired Monday night, details how British and U.S. intelligence agencies were informed by top sources months before the invasion that Iraq had no active weapons mass destruction program, and the information was not passed to subsequent inquiries. It described how Naji Sabri, Saddam's foreign minister, told the CIA station chief in Paris at the time, Bill Murray, through an intermediary that Iraq, quote, had virtually nothing in terms of weapons mass destruction. Sabri said in a statement that that it was all totally fabricated. Lord Butler, the former cabinet secretary who led an inquiry into the use of intelligence in the run-up to the invasion of Iraq, tells the program that he was not told about Sabri's comments and that he should have been. Butler says that the use of intelligence, quotes, there were ways in which people were misled. You bet. So now it's unraveling, and that means they should look upon war crimes against humanity of Tony Blair. And finally, from Professor Paul Craig Roberts from Global Research, I shall quote, "The legacy of the war on terror is the death of liberty." March 19th, 2013, 10 years ago, the Bush regime invaded Iraq. It is known that the justification for the invasion was a packet of lies orchestrated by the neoconservative Bush regime in order to deceive the United Nations and the American people. The U.S. Secretary of State at the time, General Colin Powell, has expressed his regrets that he was used by the Bush regime to deceive the United Nations with fake intelligence that the Bush and Blair regimes knew to be fake. But the despicable media has not apologized to the American people for serving the corrupt Bush regime as its ministry of propaganda and lies. It is difficult to discern which is the most despicable, the corrupt Bush regime, the press that enabled it, or the corrupt Obama regime that refuses to prosecute the Bush regime for its unambiguous war crimes, crimes against the U.S. Constitution, crimes against U.S. statutory law, and crimes against humanity. In his book, The Culture of War, the distinguished historian John Dower observes that the concrete acts of war unleashed by the Japanese in the 20th century and the Bush imperial presidency in the 21st century, quote, invite comparative analysis of outright war crimes like torture and other transgressions. Imperial Japan's black deeds have left an indelible stain on the nation's honor and good name, and it remains to be seen how lasting the damage to America's reputation will be. In this regard, the Bush administration's war planners are fortunate in having been able to evade formal and serious investigation remotely comparable to what the Allied powers pursued vis-a-vis Japan and Germany after World War II, end quote. Dower quotes Arthur Schlesinger, Jr., quote, that President Bush has adopted a policy of self-defense that is alarmingly similar to the policy of that Imperial Japan employed at Pearl Harbor. Now, Americans paid an enormous sum of money for the shame of living in infamy. Joseph Stiglitz and Linda Bilmes calculated that the Iraq War has cost us $3 trillion. This estimate might turn out to be optimistic. The latest study concludes that the war could end up costing $6 trillion. In order to pay for the profits that have flowed into the pockets of U.S. military security complex and firms, and also into political contributions, Americans are in danger of losing Social Security, Medicare, and social cohesiveness that the social welfare system provides. The human cost in Iraq of America's infamy is extraordinary. 4.5 million people displaced, as many as 1 million dead civilians, leaving widows and orphans, a professional class that has departed the country, an infrastructure in ruins, a social cohesiveness destroyed by the Sunni-Shia conflict that was ignited by Washington's destruction of Saddam's government. It is a sick joke that the United States government brought freedom and democracy to Iraq. What the Washington war criminals brought was death and the destruction of a country. The U.S. population, for the most part, seems quite at ease with the gratuitous destruction of Iraq and all that it entails. Children without parents, wives without husbands, birth defects from depleted uranium, unsafe water, a country without hope mirrored in sectarian violence. Washington's puppet state government in the UK, in Europe, in the Middle East, Japan, seem equally pleased with the victory over what? What threat did the victory defeat? There was no threat. Weapons of mass destruction was a propaganda hoax. Mushroom clouds over American cities was a fantasy propaganda. How ignorant do populations have to be to fall for such totally transparent propaganda? Is there no intelligence anywhere in the Western world? At a recent conference, the neoconservatives responsible for the deaths and ruined lives of millions and for the trillions of dollars that their wars piled on U.S. national debt were unrepentant and full of self-justification. While Washington looks abroad for evil to slay, evil is concentrated in Washington itself. The American war criminals walk about unmolested. They are paid large sums of money to make speeches about how Americans are bringing freedom and democracy to the world by invading, bombing, and murdering people. The War Crimes Tribunal has not issued arrest warrants. The U.S. Department of State, which is still hunting for Nazi war criminals, has not kidnapped the American ones and sent them to be tried at The Hague. The Americans who suffered are the 4,801 troops who lost their lives, the thousands of troops who lost limbs and suffered from other permanent wounds, the tens of thousands who suffered from post-traumatic stress and from the remorse of killing innocent people, the families and friends of the American troops, and the broken marriages and single-parent children from the war stress. Other Americans have suffered on the home front, those whose moral conscience compelled them to protest the war were beaten and abused by the police, investigated and harassed by the FDA, and put on no-fly list. Some might actually be prosecuted. The United States has reached the point where any citizen who has a moral conscience is an enemy of the state. The prosecution of Bradley Manning demonstrates this truth. A case could be made that the historian's comparison of the Bush regime with the Japanese war criminals doesn't go far enough. By this October 7th, Washington will have been killing people, mainly women, children, village elders, in Afghanistan for 12 years. No one knows why America has brought such destruction to the Afghan people. First the Soviets, then the Americans. What is the difference? When Obama came into the presidency, he admitted that no one knew what the U.S. military mission was in Afghanistan. We still don't know. The best guess is profits for the U.S. armaments industry, power for the homeland security industry, and a police state for the U.S. population. Washington has left Libya in ruins and internal conflict. There's no government, but it is not liberated. It is not a nirvana. The insistent illegal drone attacks in Pakistan have radicalized elements of Pakistanis and provoked civil war against the Pakistan government, which is owned by Washington and permits Washington murder of its citizens in exchange for Washington's money payments to the political elites who have sold out their country to Washington. I'm Gary Knoll. Those are just some thoughts on the 10th anniversary. Back in a moment with my guest. Please stay with us. Let's go to our phone right now and say hello to Dr. Sarah Gottfried. She's a Harvard-trained medical doctor and gynecologist, and she's the founder of the Gottfried Institute in Berkeley, California. She's been practicing complementary medicine for over 20 years, specializing in preventing and treating hormonal imbalances and disorders that have reached virtually epidemic proportions among men and women alike. And she is the author of The Hormone Cure, Reclaim Balance, Sleep, Sex Drive, and Vitality Naturally. Her website is sarahgottfriedmd.com. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you so much, Gary. I'm so happy to be with you.
Good. I'd like for you to focus your answers in two areas that would help individuals in this audience. When it comes to hormonal imbalance and disorders that we're treating, frequently we're treating it the wrong way. We're masking the symptoms with pills, not getting at the root causes, and secondly, adapting the changes necessary to prevent and treat hormonal disorders is far more easy than having to live with the symptoms and rely upon conventional therapies. That's my own personal opinion. Now, I'd like for you to take us through your philosophy on this and your protocols to help people understand how they get out of balance with hormones and how then you would suggest they rebalance themselves. Take your time.
Well, I completely agree with what you just described, Gary. You know, we're in a situation where both men and women are facing an epidemic of hormone imbalance, and that's why so many of us feel overwhelmed, fat, cranky, and prematurely old. And you're so right. We're told by conventional medicine that this is just how it is as you get older or if you're stressed out. And then we get offered a pharmaceutical, right? I mean, we usually get offered an antidepressant, maybe a sleeping pill, maybe a prescription for anxiety. This is what happened to me when I was in my mid-30s. I'm 46 years young now. And I was struggling then, Gary, with PMS, weight gain, low sex drive. And I went and saw my primary care physician, and I was offered Prozac. That was a defining moment for me because I looked at that prescription for Prozac, and I realized that I wasn't depressed. I realized that, oh my gosh, one in four women in the U.S. is taking a drug for mental health, one in seven men, and we are treating these problems with exactly the wrong thing. So that's when I took my medical training, applied it to my own situation, figured out that I had a couple of hormones that were out of whack. I had high cortisol, that main stress hormone. I had low thyroid function. And that's why I was cranky, fat, and, you know, feeling too young to feel so old. So I agree with you. I really believe that our healthcare system is broken. We need to look at the root cause because when we go with an antidepressant, you're far less likely to affect a cure. If you want a cure, you've got to go to the root cause. You've got to start with how you eat, move, think, and supplement.
All right. Take us through your lifestyle changes and the nutraceuticals and the herbal therapies and maybe some exercises and some bioidentical hormones. Take us through these, please.
Yeah, Yeah, well, I developed something called the Gottfried Protocol, and this is the way that I was able to rebalance my own hormones when I was in my mid-30s. And the idea with the Gottfried Protocol is that you start by figuring out what the root causes of why you don't feel good. So for me, my main problem was that I had high cortisol. Cortisol is that stress hormone. I kind of think of it as the bad boyfriend hormone. It's the hormone that you knew you shouldn't have dated in high school or college. You did, and it went poorly. It didn't end well. It blew up in your face. Cortisol is a bit like that. And it's also the hormone that tends to shut down other hormones, especially when it's high. So I developed this protocol. It took me about 4 weeks to get my cortisol back into the Goldilocks position of not too high, not too low. And when I did that, it just made all the difference. And so that's what I then brought to my clients, the next 10,000 people that I took care of in my practice. And it was wildly successful. So here's what it looks like. It's a three-step process. The first step is that you address the nutritional gaps that you have as a result of your hormone imbalance. You figure out what your hormone imbalance is. My book takes you through this by using the questionnaires that I have.
Take us through this. Take us through it now.
Sure. So first step is that you fill in these nutritional gaps. You also make the lifestyle tweaks that really help you get this hormone problem into balance. So for instance, in my situation, I had high cortisol. And what I did was I learned my top five strategies for how to hit the pause button when it comes to stress, how to create that gap between stimulus and response. You know, Viktor Frankl talks about creating that gap so that you're not as reactive. Cortisol can get the best of you, and we don't want that to happen. So I had a few strategies. I happened to find that yoga was very effective for me. I also use some of the heart math strategies. Those were very helpful for me to calm my system down. A lot of women, especially, are in a state of hypervigilance. I think that's sort of the modern woman's greatest struggle, is hypervigilance, running from task to task, feeling overwhelmed. We've got to learn how to hit the pause button. And that top five list of how to do it is different from person to person, but I think it's especially important when you're struggling with high cortisol. And cortisol can give you sugar cravings when it's too high. It can also cause problems with laying down too much belly fat, having a muffin top. That's what I had in my 30s. I also started a supplement that really made a difference for me, and that was phosphatidylserine. Phosphatidylserine. We also know that omega-3s are very effective at lowering your cortisol level. So those are all step one of the Gottfried Protocol. You fill in nutritional gaps. You make the lifestyle tweaks that help you get into balance. Step two is proven botanical therapies. And then step three is bioidentical hormones, but at the lowest doses and for the shortest duration.
Good. That's one answer. Now deal with bioidentical hormones.
Well, bioidentical hormones, I think, are very interesting. I have a lot of people who come to see me, and they say, okay, fine, pause button, I hear what you're saying, I'm not going to a yoga class, just give me the big guns, just give me a prescription for testosterone for my low sex drive. And what I found, Gary, is that when you skip those lifestyle changes, when you just skip step one of the Gottfried Protocol, step two, and you jump to the bioidenticals, you're far less likely to get the greatest benefit from those bioidenticals.
Okay, then so, what is step two?
So step two is proven botanical therapies. So if we go, for instance, to my issue of high cortisol, which is what I see in about 91% of the people who come to my virtual practice, rhodiola is one of the most effective botanicals, herbal therapies that helps to lower your cortisol level. So I'm a fan of really trying these proven botanicals, the things that have been used for thousands of years and have been shown to be effective in recent randomized trials that are well designed.
Beyond rhodiola, what else?
Beyond rhodiola, there's several other adaptogens that are effective. Ashwagandha is a great example. I also am a fan of some of the ginsengs. I think those really help in terms of cortisol levels. It depends on which hormone imbalance you're talking about. If we're talking about cortisol, those are the key botanical therapies that I find to be effective.
What is your stage three?
My stage three then is to do bioidentical hormones. And, you know, another important piece here when it comes to balancing your hormones is I really think we need to start a revolution with a shopping cart. And this is a place where I admire you so much, Gary, with your work on power foods. It's amazing to me how much power foods can actually balance your hormones. And I think a lot of people don't realize that. They think that they need a prescription for the latest bioidentical hormone. And it turns out that much of your hormone balance actually comes with your fork. So we're talking here about green vegetables, about having green smoothies, eating low glycemic index fruits, eating organic whenever possible. Dark chocolate lowers your cortisol. I think that's a really important power food.
Good. And stage four?
So I have three stages when it comes to the Gottfried protocol. So for, you know, one of the latest ways of thinking about hormones, kind of the cutting edge when it comes to hormone science, is the problem of hormone resistance. And I think our listeners are going to hear more about this in the next 5 to 10 years. You probably have heard of insulin resistance, where cells become numb to insulin. It turns out that you can become resistant to many of these hormones that we're talking about. So for women, I talk about three main hormones that you want to have working for you, not against you. I call them your hormonal Charlie's Angels, and they are your cortisol, your estrogen, and your thyroid. And in men, I call it your hormonal three amigos, your cortisol, testosterone, and thyroid. But this issue of hormone resistance is very important. I don't think it's a good idea to just go on a dose of bioidentical hormones and stay on that dose forever. I don't think that's the best thing for the body. What we know is that just like with insulin resistance, when your cells become numb to insulin, you can also develop thyroid resistance. You can develop cortisol resistance or glucocorticoid resistance. You can develop estrogen resistance, progesterone resistance. That's the main mechanism of premenstrual syndrome. So I'm not a fan of just going on bioidentical hormones and then increasing the dose to continue to get the same effect. I don't think that's the best thing for the body. I would rather that people be working more in the step one and the step two with the lifestyle changes, the food choices, the way you eat, move, think, and supplement.
Makes a lot of sense. Sarah, we're out of time. I thank you for coming on and introducing this audience to your program. Hopefully they'll follow up with it. Website is Sarah Gottlieb, GottfriedMD.com. And the book is The Hormone Cure. Nice to have you with us today, Sarah.
Thank you so much, Gary.
And that brings up the end of our program, and I want to thank you all for joining us. Now, let's go to our talk back. Your turn to call in now at 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888, and I'll take as many of those calls as possible. And let's start with Luann Panessi, and then I'll take the calls as they come in, one after the other. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. As you may or may not know, you have a lot of college students that listen to your show. And I have one student here from Boston College, and she asked this question. I thought it was very intriguing. For all of us millennials who truly believe that we will not have the same quality of life as our parents and grandparents, what advice can you give us beyond what we're learning in college to help us live a sustainable life now?
That's a good question. I just realized I'd missed one important program announcement, and that is that we're looking for some volunteers to pick up our guest tomorrow and at the airports, LaGuardia Airport, and then on Friday to bring him into the studio from Manhattan, take him back. So we could use three or four different volunteers. We have a big two-hour special on Friday on Gardasil. These people are flying in from around the United States. If you can volunteer to even be at one leg of that, just picking someone up the airport, bringing the city, taking the city to the studio back to where they're staying, give a call at 646 646-926-5422, 646-926-5422. Here's what I would say, especially for younger people or people who are really not going to be fitting back into their previous careers that they have lost or been downsized. Begin the process of examining how you live. Look at what you need for happiness, and then see what can you do to actually take a step back, if need be, living below your means. Because we have been in this growth cycle that we believe every generation should have more than the previous generation. That's why we baby boomers were spoiled. We were spoiled by the generation, the greatest generation, that sacrificed so much for us. They didn't want us to go through hungry days and nights, homelessness, traveling the rails on boxcars. So after the Second World War, they worked harder than any generation I could imagine to prevent us from having to sacrifice. We wanted to go to school. They wanted us to go to college. Well, we have to realize that's got to stop. We cannot now, and nor for the vast majority of Americans, at least 270 million Americans, or 240 million Americans, we can no longer look at the future of having more as being a yardstick. And a lot of people go to college and graduate school and postgraduate school, creating mountains of debt with the assumption that they'll be better off. That's no guarantee today. So when I suggest that you look at what you can do with less, that means instead of going from a lot to dire poverty, look at where could you live? Could you have shared living? How much clothes do you need? And then don't measure it against what you want or what you have had. People in California alone, one state, throw away as much food as what would be needed to feed people in India for a whole week. That's how much we waste. So we don't need everything that we have surrounded ourselves with. So that's very important. Also, I believe in what I first learned this lesson from my aunt Mildred, my mother's sister. I was once over to her place where my cousins were, and we were playing, and we were playing all over the house, and I noticed her closet, and I know she didn't have a lot of clothes, and I was curious about that, so I just asked her, and she said, you're right, I don't have a lot of dresses. I only have 3 dresses and 2 pair of shoes, and that's because I wait to get the best I can get, something of quality that will not be threadbare. And she said, so it's quality. It's easier to maintain. It lasts longer. You're happier with it. For some reason, that lesson stuck in my brain. Because then when I was in France, I also was in a home for lots of homes where I asked about their standard of living. And I saw very little clothes in men and women's closets because I was curious. But what they do have, it's of quality. Americans have got to get out of this obsolescence mindset of going to the malls or going to the box stores and buying crap and then throwing it away and not being in it. Buy less, but buy better quality. Also, I believe that most young people have to learn something other than what they're mastering in college. They have to learn crafts that are functional and skills that are functional through fair exchange and barter. So let's say you're going to school. Well, why not learn how to make bread? Why not learn how to make sandwiches, super sandwiches, and sell them to other students? You can do a lot of things if you develop some other skills. We're a society that has too few skills, and stop the idea of expecting everyone to come and fix something for you when it's broken. Develop that self-sufficiency. Be more rounded, and that will help also. Simplify your life. Hope that answers the question. Let's say hello to Alan from Brooklyn. Hi, Alan.
Hi, Gary. Very, very interesting programs.
Thank you.
I was wondering, with Bush and Cheney, I saw a documentary on Cheney the other day called The World According to Cheney, and it's like watching the devil. He's out fly fishing while without any consciousness. He reminds me of a Nazi that retired after World War II. Anyway, what do you think the consequences, what do you think the blowback to America might be?
None. there won't be any blowback. There'll just be continued muted or vocal anger, because most young people are not as angry at the United States for enabling the dictators and the juntas. They're angry at their own predicament, their own lack of jobs, their own lack of clean water or food, incarceration, lack of rights. So the energy is not a blowback energy at this point, and nothing's going to happen to Bush or Cheney, not in our lifetimes. Last call, let's say hello to Harvey from Berkeley. Hi, Harvey.
Hi, Gary. Well, you talked about water yesterday and today, and I'd like to tell you, take a minute to tell you what I, to define the problem more, and another minute to give...
Well, hold on. If that's the issue, Harvey, call tomorrow and I'll give you the time to talk about water, because we're out of time. I thought it was some little short statement, but I'll be happy to entertain your thoughts tomorrow, and I'll set aside time for that. We're out of time. I want to thank you all for listening. And let's say hello to Utrice Lead. Hi, Utrice.
Hello, Gary. Today we'll be talking with a former Secret Service agent who personally was drafted by President Kennedy, and the price he has had to pay for justice.
We look forward to it. Utrice Lead, right now on the Progressive Radio Network.